We'll call the Energy Finance and Policy Division to order. We do have a quorum wandering around here somewhere. As members are aware, we have one bill on the agenda today, House File 357. Representative Falk's bill regarding seabed contracts. We have a number of people who wish to testify for and against the bill, and it's my desire to accommodate them. We have more than we can possibly get through today, so it would be my intention to hear as much testimony as we can today, with a particular focus on accommodating those testifiers who have come from out of town. And then we would lay the bill over and take it up again on Monday. I don't believe that we have any amendments that have been submitted to the committee at this time. If there are amendments of any kind, I would hope to defer consideration of those until Monday. As I said, we do have an extensive list of testifiers, which we will do our best to get through. And if members could be appreciative of that and try to keep questions and editorial comments as brief as possible, that would be greatly appreciated. First order of business, as Ms. Smith always reminds me, is approval of the minutes. I would entertain a motion to that effect.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the motion for the minutes on the 16th of February.
Thank you, Representative Nornes. We have a motion before us. Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes? All those in favor of their adoption, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Representative Falk, to your bill.
I would like to move that House File 357 be recommended to pass and be placed in the General Register. And I would also like to move the DE3 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I'd like to have it.
Representative Falk moves the DE3 amendment. Is there any discussion to that? Seeing none, all those in favor of its adoption, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Falk, to your bill as amended.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, this bill is an roadmap to develop standardized contracts for community-owned projects, and I would say this is kind of reactive policy. We've seen some struggles with trying to help our communities facilitate ways for them to be involved in this new energy, these new renewable energy resources which we're trying to develop. And so what we're doing is we're creating a means for 5 megawatt under projects to receive a market-derived price through the Midwest Independent System Operators last year's average price and the purchasing utilities discount rate for what they would expend on capital. Additionally, we're looking at directing the Public Utilities Commission to create a standardized contract for projects that are greater than 5 megawatts. And we're also looking at what we can do to ensure that community ownership, community-owned projects, have a real shot at this renewable energy that we're going to be developing as a result of the renewable energy standard passed in 2007.
Is this, you're not picking me up, I apologize.
I have just a wonderful group of testifiers lined up. I don't want to take up too much time. But what we're really looking at is how does Minnesota best develop and benefit from this renewable energy resource which we have to ensure that the benefits stay locally, that we keep the jobs locally, we keep the dollars local, we keep that these companies will be paying taxes in Minnesota. And given our current economic crisis and the situation we're in, we're seeing day after day that we need to do all we can to help grow our economy in Minnesota. I don't want to take up too much time or take time away from my testifiers, but I would like to invite my first group of testifiers up. That's Dan Jewell,
and the highly esteemed General Wesley Clark will be speaking to the bill, so I'd invite them up.
Mr. Jewell, General Clark, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, my name is Dan Jewell. I'm from Woodstock, Minnesota, and I'm here to testify in favor of House File 357. As a lot of you know, we've been involved in the seabed things for quite a while. I think it's been 3 or 4 years since we started working on this, and 357 is basically a reaction to, like Representative Falk said, that we need to try to get something happening for the small community-based projects. And the two provisions of the bill, the first one is that for projects over 5 megawatts, we're looking to have a standardized contract put into place. And the reason why we want to do that is because our experience has been that if you win a request for proposals, if a utility puts out a bid package for community-based to bid on it, and you win the bid, it usually takes between 6 months and a year to get the contract in the signable form. And in that time, your economics fall off, everything spins out of control, and then things just don't get done. And we've had discussions with several utilities on this, and they feel that a standardized contract, in fact, it was part of the task force that was formed, when was that, last year? Or 2 years ago, to look at seabed and how we can get more community-based projects going. And so that is the provision that will allow bid community projects, the bigger projects, where the experienced developers can go in there and bid on a project, and then if they win the bid, they can mobilize their capital and move the project along. The second part of the bill is for 5 megawatts and under, which basically is designed to help small communities or small groups of people and communities throughout the state get involved in community-based development and create a vehicle for them to be able to do wind projects, because the small communities don't have the wherewithal to go into the bidding procedure on the large projects, and there needs to be some sort of an established tariff rate put in place that allows the project to get financed and allows these projects to move ahead. Because I think we can really use our want for renewable energy as an economic development tool. Community-based projects create jobs locally. We use local contractors. We use local engineers, lawyers. Everybody is local. And the big thing is that the energy dollars stay in our state and in our community. And I can just lay testament to the fact that where I live in the Buffalo Ridge, where we have about 1,000 megawatts of wind power online, and most all of those projects are owned by foreign multinational companies, we export something in the area of $100 million a year in revenue streams out of our state. That's money that we could keep in our state and keep our economies going in the long run. And that's what this bill starts to do. And I know the provision says that the 5 megawatts and under is to limit it at 200 megawatts. And I think that's a good first step to try to get things on the table and moving and allow us to see what this can really do to create jobs in our communities and in our state. And so I urge passage of House File 357. With us today is General Wesley Clark. He's on our board of directors and a friend of renewable energy, and he wants to make a few comments. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
General Clark, welcome. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. It's a pleasure to be here in Minnesota today and to testify in front of this committee, and I appreciate the chance to put some perspective on what Dan Jewell has said. As Dan said, I'm a business partner of his in Jewell Energy. I'm on his board of directors. I'm also in the investment banking business. I'm chairman of a small investment bank. We haven't taken any federal money, and none has been offered in New York City. And I'm also the chairman of the North American branch of a wind turbine manufacturing. After my late and lamented foray into high elected politics, I decided that maybe there was a different way to do something good for the country, and I've always been concerned about energy independence and the impact of our dependence on imported energy on our national security.
Before you proceed, I neglected to mention that we do need to have you identify yourself for the record.
Sorry.
Irrelevant as that may be.
I'm Wesley Clark, and I'm from Little Rock, Arkansas, and I'm happy to be up here in Minnesota. But so I decided I would try to do something good, and I looked at the renewable sector, and so happened that I looked at wind as it's a mature renewable technology. A lot of effort's gone over the last 30 years into maturing the technology for wind turbines. And there's been a lot of effort put in to financing wind park development. And the United States right now is, just in 2008, actually took the lead in installed wind energy generation in the world. But the model leaves a lot to be desired. The problem with the model the United States has been using is it has relied on massive wind park developments, which overload grids, take a long time to develop, and basically they restrict the participation in the development to a few people who rent their land out, and then normally it's big financial institutions and big utility companies, often foreign-owned, who come in and do this. What is really going to ignite this market is the ability to help ordinary Americans across the Midwest participate in the development of America's wind energy resources. And the mechanism to do that varies state by state. But in Minnesota, I believe that seabed legislation is critical, especially in the 5 megawatts and below range, because it opens up the opportunity for community wind development, small projects. And yet, with a fixed rate structure, these projects can be financed. And with the support of the local communities and the set-aside that's in the bill for maintenance and servicing, it'll be just as reliable and just as efficient as a big project. And I can tell you that the financial community, now that the stimulus bill has been passed, is going to look very eagerly at projects like this. They like it because it's non-lumpy revenue. This is an important national security issue for us, and it's right here on Minnesota voters. Basically, we are dependent on millions of barrels of imported oil a year. In June last year, we were running at a rate of $500 billion a year shipped abroad to pay for that oil. That creates a net loss of revenue and money and resources from the United States. It gives it to a lot of people who aren't in our interest and don't take actions in our interest, and it also distorts America's foreign policy. So the price of oil has dropped since then, but we're still importing oil from abroad. And at home, we're using carbon-based fuels that are contributing to another national security threat, and that's global warming or climate change. It's real. The scientific community's pretty much coalesced on this, that yes, global warming is real, and it is to some significant extent caused by the man-made emissions of greenhouse gases. In fact, the latest information released in the press at the start of this week said that the 2007-2008 climate models of the UN are wrong, that it's going to occur even faster. So what we need to do is move away from carbon-based fuels to the extent that we can. And so investing in wind in Minnesota is a big step in the right direction for America's national security, both to free us from dependence on imported petroleum products and also to reduce the footprint of greenhouse global warming. I think the seabed legislation does a lot to help us move in that direction. It makes investments in wind energy practical in the near term. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, General. Are there questions for either of these witnesses at this time? Seeing none, thank you very much. Oops. Pardon me? Representative Weston.
Mr. Chair, just because I think the question is going to come up and maybe later is better to deal with this, and if people want to defer, the witnesses want to defer, that's fine. But I know the issue is going to come up about the price structure mechanism in the bill, and I guess to Mr. Jewell, just any comments on why this mechanism is in the bill, or how you came up with that formula, and is it just arbitrary, or I mean, how do you come up with the pricing mechanism that you've come up with in the bill?
Mr. Jewell, Mr. Chairman, Representative Westrom, it was not an arbitrary thing. We looked at the pricing. We established the seabed front-loaded characteristics in the first seabed bills, where we wanted to do a front-loaded contract, and we wanted to look at the net present value over the life, because these projects, renewable energy, basically, the cost of the energy is the cost of the capital. And so if you can, when you look at the long term of it, we can do fixed rate energy pricing on this type of energy. No other energy resource will do that. Not even the big developer wind projects do fixed pricing or that stay level. And so what we did is we looked at that and said, okay, we want to make this so it's a financeable thing. We don't want to call it a feed-in tariff. It's not a feed-in tariff. It's a community-based tariff that will allow the financing. And how we looked at it was, we say, if we take last year's system average, and when I say the system, we're tied into the Midwest Independent Systems Operator, the MISO, which I'm sure we've all heard about, and that dictates the price of energy in our hub, in this whole region. And so we thought, if we took last year's average price, or the previous year's average price in the MISO system, and used that as the net present value target on our contract, we're basically locking in on a 20-year contract based on last year's price. And so it was not an arbitrary number. It was a number that we figured that would be defensible in the fact that we're using last year's pricing, net present value, over the life of the contract. And what that allows us to do is it allows us to front-load the contract so the community can debt service the machinery and get the debt service paid off. And once the debt service is paid off, you can actually drop the price of energy. And so what it does is two things. In the first 10 years, it drives economic development jobs that we really need. And the second 10 years, it drives the price of energy down, and locks us down in a fixed rate price of energy that will be lower than it is now. Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to add one thing. In relation to General Clark's comments, we're looking at this also from the standpoint, we're involved in a lot of different areas in the energy game, and we're looking at car transportation, electric cars, and we're seeing an explosion of that technology, and that's really coming down the pipeline in a big way. And if we're able to start getting communities involved in rural Minnesota, involved in building small community-owned wind farms and producing this electric power in their community, they're laying the foundation for their transportation fuel for years to come. And that directly addresses General Clark's comment about our dependence on foreign oil. If we develop our own energy resources and put them in our backyard, and then the technology is coming along where we can use that to transport ourselves around, that's going to be a big value to us in rural Minnesota, who pay a lot of money for gas to get from point A to point B. And so I just wanted to make that comment.
Sort of like growing hay for the horses.
Sort of.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. General Clark, first, thank you for your service, both in uniform and now in a different way to this country. And on the Green Jobs Task Force, one of the things that's really frustrated me personally, I know Representative Gunther and others, is seeing other states benefit from our policies. In fact, Governor Culver in Iowa doesn't just show up at the trade shows and hand out his card with his personal cell phone, but he'll then hold up a map that has Iowa and Minnesota on it, and he says, Minnesota has the strongest renewable energy standard in the country. We're going to build those turbines in northern Iowa. They now have 5 turbine plants. Can you address why you believe that this seabed legislation may be a tool that could compete with other states' incentives, since we don't do tax credits very willingly?
Yes, I can, because I do have some familiarity with Iowa, and Governor Culver has gone all out to make wind energy a big part of it, not only through building the turbines, but through creating an environment in which people use those turbines and install them. So I had the privilege of sitting in one of these community meetings in Iowa. A group of local farmers got together. They were pitched on the idea of turbine, just like community wind. The rate was established. There was not going to be any discussion with it. In fact, they had a principle that you could put in, I think, if I remember this right, it was like 2.5 megawatts per substation in rural Iowa, and the substations were running about 4 square miles apart without any interconnection study. You just plug it right into the grid so it goes right in. There was a payment plan and a rollover plan, and the local farmers got some maintenance fees on it, and then they got a percentage of the revenues from it, and it was all a very smooth financial model. I later found out it was Dan Jewell's financial model that they had pirated and were exploiting in Iowa. But Iowa had a couple of advantages, namely that they boosted the rate a little bit to make sure it was affordable for the investor to come in there, and it was a fixed feed-in rate, so they knew what it was going to be. And also, they had the opportunity to just plug it right in at the substation level without doing any studies. Now, across the United States, there are thousands and thousands of megawatts in big wind development out there. They're all waiting for studies to see what the impact of wind is on the grid. Does it overwhelm the base load? Can it be maintained in periods of high demand and low demand? And what's the impact of the intermittency on it? And these studies are expensive. They're done in sequential fashion, and in some areas, the studies are stacked up in a queue that's maybe 20 years long. What the community legislation does, what the seabed legislation does, it lets Minnesota jump up there and get a big lead in terms of actually installing the wind. Because this can be installed, it can be installed quickly here like this, just like Iowa has already jumped ahead to bypass these queues. So that's why in the financial community and in the national security community, this is such an interesting proposition.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Generally, and I ask you this, I noted the long line of witnesses that we have, but this one is unique to you, and that is you've raised the topic of economic security, energy security. And my question is one of perspective for the ballpark that we're playing in. With Representative Falk's bill, allegedly we're going to pay more money. The rates might be arguably higher. But if the trade-off is economic security, energy security, maybe it's worth that. My question to you, and maybe it's an unfair one, but you're probably used to unfair questions with all the background you've got. The question is, how many of these do we have to do? How many of Representative Falk's bills do we have to pass to achieve what you're talking about with respect to energy security, economic security? Do we have to do this 100 times, 1,000 times?
I don't know if that's, maybe that's a question that Representative Falk has to answer, because I don't know what kind of bills he might write.
But neither do we, gentlemen.
But this is a very, to me, this was, and I first learned about this legislation a couple of months ago, and to me it's an obvious solution to what has become a procedural roadblock here in Minnesota for being able to distribute wind energy. If you can distribute wind energy, you reduce the difficulties of blending it into the grid, you make it more accessible to the community, and you make it in small enough bites that local investors and local banks can participate in the financing, the ownership, and to keep the revenue in the state. And that's the idea behind this. When you're talking about a $500 million wind project, it sounds great in the newspaper, but when 92% of that money goes outside the state and in many cases outside the country, you have to wonder how much it's really contributing to our overall economic security. So I think that this idea is a very powerful idea in terms of being able to address fundamental energy security. You know, when the United States and our oil companies began working in the Middle East back after the Second World War, those countries didn't have much over there except what was in the ground. And we began to take it out, and our energy companies made a lot of money on it, and people in the United States used it. Eventually, those countries decided they would have to nationalize that resource so that they kept the benefits at home. Well, we don't have to worry about nationalization in the United States, at least of electricity energy right now. What we have to do is set up the right procedures, because we've got plenty of smart people, we've got plenty of entrepreneurship, and we've got plenty of our own finances, and in Minnesota and the upper Midwest, we've got plenty of wind. We can become totally self-sufficient in energy if we do this the right way in this country. We can do it very quickly, and we can do it at a very affordable price. And one of the things, Representative Atkins, that struck me in Dan's model here is I really like the idea that the pricing on the seabed is, it's front-loaded so that you can get financing for it if you're in a small community, because you got to pay, you can't do it all with equity investment, you got to borrow some money on it. And then it gets cheaper as you go. And it's the opposite of every other thing that happens in the economy. And so this energy installed in 2009, 2010, 2011 in Minnesota, if this legislation passes, in 2021 and 2031, people are going to look at it and say, God, it's like, you know, it's like it's just coming out of the air. It's going to be like free energy at that point, at that price. Because once the capital investment is taken, it's there for us. So I think it's a very sensible proposal, and I hope Representative Brock will put many more bills like this forward.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is to build on Representative Atkins' question. Thank you for testifying to our committee, and thank you for helping him get here, Representative Falk. But my question, and for my colleagues who don't think climate change is something we need to be worrying about, it doesn't necessarily have to do with this. This bill stands on its merits outside of that. But I just was wondering if you could expand a little bit on your comments about climate security and your perspective as a national security expert and having worked on that for many years, and talking about the models of the UN has put out being wrong, and it's happening faster. And Representative Atkins asked about energy security and taking that a step further and looking at climate security and how that might interact both with this bill but also more generally.
Well, I first became aware of the real global warming issues when I was the Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Southern Command in Panama. And I went down with the Secretary of Defense one afternoon in a Gulfstream. We flew down the west coast of South America, and I was looking at the map, and I don't know if you've ever flown from Peru south along the Chilean coastline, but it was one of these memorable flights where you look at the sun setting, and the Andes is not like the Rockies. I mean, the Andes is only about three mountains thick. It's a very narrow range in South America, and you can see these peaks, and you look at them, and they're named. They're 21,000 feet, and we were looking at them, and there was no snow. And this was October. So it had just been through the southern hemisphere's winter. And on the maps, it showed snow-covered glaciers, and you could see there wasn't very much there. And I started to get serious then and started to talk about to people in South America about changes in the climate. They had already felt it there. It started in the 90s there. I know it's become, a partisan issue, and I see both sides of the issue because I get a lot of information from some of my friends on the other side. But I think the balance of scientific opinion is that global warming is occurring, that it is not totally, but to some substantial majority proportion caused by the emission of greenhouse gases. The U.S. Army War College in 2003-2004 took a look at the impact of climate change. They looked at the previous UN models, they looked at the change in rainfall pattern, the effect of change in rainfall pattern on agriculture and wealth. They looked at the melting of the glaciers and the Greenland ice cap and the constant rise in sea levels and what that did to hundreds of millions of people who are living within 10 feet of sea level around the world. And they saw that this kind of climate change will create massive economic pressures. For example, some 2 billion people live off the glaciers that flow off the Tibetan Plateau and out of the Himalayas. They live off that because the rivers flow all year round, even though it doesn't rain, because the glaciers melt. But those glaciers are melting, and they're not being replaced right now. And so everyone is seeing that recession of those glaciers. As that water flow stops, land becomes non-cultivatable and ultimately maybe not even inhabitable. At the same time, as sea levels rise, people in nations like Bangladesh or in states even like Florida or cities like New Orleans have greater difficulty. Now, we can handle Florida and I think New Orleans in the United States, but nations around the world, especially poorer nations, can't handle it. They can't handle a change in rainfall pattern. They can't handle a rising sea level. They can't handle a change in disease, the impact on agricultural production. And these will create stresses which create, in turn, national security issues. So that's the national security connection on global warming. Can we stop it? No, probably not. But we can slow it down if we get the right mix of policies in here, and moving toward renewable energy as rapidly as possible is one of those policies. I think it's just sensible. This global warming argument is one of these crazy arguments that if you ever waited to see it absolutely proved, it'd be too late totally to be able to deal with it. So we have to use the best information we have, the best scientists we have, the best models we have, and forecast what's happening, and it's a very glum prediction. And that's one of the reasons why I'm strongly advocating for renewable energy as soon as we can get it.
Members, we have one more member on the list right now. We do have a long agenda. I know General Clark also has an engagement that is going to cause him to leave in a few minutes. Representative Anderson, if you have
any
questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Falk, what are we talking about as an average day ahead market price that we're going to start out with once we put this thing in on the system? What are we looking at for a price to start out at?
Well, I could give a definition, but being that I have an expert in renewable energy and energy development and the pricing, I'll defer to Mr. Jewell on this one.
Mr. Jewell. Mr. Chairman, the average day-ahead pricing that we're talking about is that if you take the MISO, the Midwest Systems Operator, over the whole year, the price of power will go up and down according to it's hot out, it's not so hot, it's cold, and it goes up and down. And so there's a bottom end price, and then there's a peak price. And so what we're looking at is the day ahead system average, because the utilities buy power on a day ahead basis. They'll contract, they'll look at the weather maps, and they'll say, well, it looks like it's going to be 90 degrees tomorrow. We know we're going to be needing so much power. And so they'll buy day ahead pricing. And so that sets a price target. And so what we're doing is we're going back and looking at last year's historical pricing on an average basis. What's the average price that the utilities paid for power over the whole year? And that's what we're looking at as the net present value target rate on this tariff, on the CZ tariff, is last year's average price. Does that make sense?
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Jewell, oh, it's nice to say Mr. Jewell. I put you in status already. From what Representative Atkins mentioned, it sounds like this price, because of the different way it's going to be implemented, we're going to have a higher price per megawatt or unit of energy starting out with. What do you project that the difference will be between what we're paying now for energy and once this bill gets passed and put in the system? What's it going to cost the average ratepayer more per megawatt of energy by putting this bill into place?
Mr. Jewell. Mr. Chairman, of New Management, the average ratepayer is probably not going to see from what we're putting into this bill, because if you take the difference between what the seabed rate will be on these 200 megawatts and the difference between the utility price today and that price, which is a little bit more, and amortize that system wide, it's not going to have, the ratepayer is not going to hardly see it at all. But if you have to look at this, you got to remember we're talking about a 20-year long-term contract on this. We need to look at how we're buying energy over the life of the contract. And so looking at this year's price doesn't make any sense. And I think one of the handouts you have, it's got two different net present value pricing mechanisms in it. One is where you start out with today's price and that and then it escalates over time, and that's what most of the bigger companies do, is they start here and then they escalate up. And what the seedbed price does is it starts a little bit higher, but it stays there and it actually drops down. And so over the life of the contract, the consumer is going to be the winner on this type of pricing.
Well, Mr. Chair, just one last question.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Jewell, I know what it means in the state government when it says a little bit. It's like a couple billion more. So when you say little bit, I'd really like to know what that little bit is defined as when it comes down to cost. And I know you don't know the answer to that, but that's my concern is when you say a little bit, it's a lot, I think.
Mr. Jewell. Mr. Chairman, if you're asking, a little bit in this case means a couple cents per kilowatt hour for the first couple of years.
Gentlemen, I know you have a schedule to kilowatt
hour
to keep.
Just for the energy that's here, which is a very small percent of the total energy. Can I just think it through the mathematics? Sorry, and Dan is the technical expert on this. But I just wanted to clarify in response to your question, sir, that what you're talking about here is a small, very small proportion of Minnesota's total electric power that's used. So that I think the figure for Minnesota, and you all would know better than me, is like 15,000 megawatts is the sort of average usage. And here we're talking about 200 megawatts on the seabed, less than 5 megawatt proposal, and a total of 800 megawatts. So it's less than 6%, 5% of the total energy. So if you paid a penny or a penny and a half more per kilowatt for less than 6% of the energy, the impact is far less than that. It's more like 1/10 or 0.15 cent per kilowatt rather than across the system, rather than 1 or 2 cents per kilowatt. And that really is an insignificant number. In addition to which, that you're buying this energy at an average rate, whereas the utility is selling it, in some cases, at a peak rate of 5-10 times what they're paying for it, given peak pricing in the way that utilities deal with it. So this is a good deal, a very good deal for the people of Minnesota. It's reasonable priced energy, and it's wealth that is here in the state. So I'm very excited to testify for it. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for this opportunity.
General Clark, thank you, Mr. Jewell.
Thank you.
Well, members, as I pointed out earlier, we do have an extensive agenda. Next on the list is Deb Bergen from Missouri River Energy Services. I would ask the testifiers, if we're going to get through the list of those who are from out of town, we need to ask people to limit their testimony to 5 to 7 minutes. Ms. Bergen,
yes,
welcome to the committee.
Yes, Chairman Hilty. I have prepared remarks, but I will try to shorten them as I go to conform with the time limits. Chairman Hilty, members of the committee, my name is Deborah Bergen. I'm with Missouri River Energy Services, and I'd like to thank you for allowing me to testify today. Missouri River Energy Services is headquartered in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. We have 60 municipal electric community members in 4 states, Iowa, South Dakota, North Dakota, and of course, 24 of our members are here in Minnesota. I'd like to first point out that in 2007, this state passed the Renewable Energy Standard, and during debates on that bill, the utilities expressed concerns over costs of the bill. We also expressed concerns over barriers that may hinder the progress of the renewable energy standard. Those concerns led to language being added that allowed the Public Utilities Commission to modify or delay the implementation of the renewable energy standard upon consideration of impacts on customer utility costs, reliability impacts, technical barriers, delays in permitting, including transmission plate permitting, delays in construction, or other problems. Additionally, the Renewable Energy Standard allowed that generation did not have to be built in Minnesota, thereby allowing, in fact, encouraging utilities to seek out the best projects at the best possible cost for their customers. In its efforts to comply with the Renewable Energy Standard, MRES has power purchase agreements with 34.7 megawatts of seabed projects in the state of Minnesota. They are located near the cities of Marshall and St. James, Minnesota, and these projects, agreeably, were not easy to come by. These projects include 8 owners totally, financing entities, and turbine manufacturers. They also included getting together the logistics of construction, cement, crane rentals, etc., but we managed to get them off the ground and running. At this point in time, Missouri River Energy Services' new renewable energy towards renewable energy standard is 50% seabed. 50% of it comes from seabed projects. So we are proud of the efforts we've already made. However, we do have concerns with the bill in front of you, House File 357. Flexibility is our first concern. As I stated, we have 60 members in 4 states. Not only do we have the renewable energy standard that we are aggregating our 24 Minnesota members with for, and are meeting that working to meet that renewable energy standard, but we also have a renewable energy objective in South Dakota and a renewable energy objective in North Dakota. So we are working on 3 different mandates, if you will, in 3 different states for our municipal members. With these different requirements, we need the flexibility to seek out projects that have the best wind regime or the best solar regime or the highest capacity factor at the best possible price. We also want to seek projects that are located in places where the transmission wheeling cost would be lower for our members. We are in MRES, and our members are not-for-profit, so costs are very important to us because ultimately, as not-for-profits, the customer owners of the municipal electrics bear the cost. We believe that the bill before you denies that flexibility. It requires MRES only to build its next renewable resources in Minnesota, and then only if it's a seabed project, preferably 5 megawatts or less. We are concerned that MRES would have to be required to forego high generating wind farms, perhaps in South Dakota or North Dakota. Or we would be required to forego a lower cost biomass project, say in Luverne, Minnesota, because it is not seabed and is not 5 megawatts or less. It is counterproductive and counterintuitive to select some renewable projects over others. Fairness is our next concern. As I stated, we have 34.7 megawatts of seabed on the ground in Minnesota. MRES represents roughly 1.3% of the Minnesota load, yet if you use that 800 seabed number, we represent probably 4.3% of an 800 megawatt number in seabed projects. So we represent quite a bit of that percentage based on what our load is, in comparative to what our load is. Our concern is that the bill before you requires that before we can build any other renewable energy project, we must look at seabed first. If seabed has not reached 800 in this state, we are denied building that next project if we don't find a seabed project that meets our needs. Even if, the way we read the bill, even if MRS built 700 megawatts of seabed on our own, if we wanted to build a biomass project in Luverne, Minnesota next that was not seabed, we would be denied that opportunity. Reliability is also a concern of ours. As you all know, wind and solar are intermittent. Most renewables are, or the popular renewables are. So we will need to build natural gas peaking facilities to follow the intermittency of wind. As we read this bill, we would be denied the opportunity to build natural gas until 800 megawatts of seabed is built in this state. That concerns us with reliability. As wind varies throughout the day, we need our natural gas to follow the load and dispatch to meet demand. That is a big concern of ours. As we go forward with more intermittent generation, we become increasingly reliant on things like natural gas that are quick startup times and can easily follow load and compensate for the intermittency. Costs are a final concern. You're going to hear a lot of testimony about costs, but I'm going to take it in a little different direction. And that's being the cost of lost opportunities. The bill before you, our concern is that it makes us take a Hobson's choice. We work in four different states, and we want to choose the renewables that have the highest capacity factor at the lowest possible cost. The way we interpret this bill is that we would have to forego a project that may have a 40%, a wind project, that may have a 40% capacity factor that is not CDEV, in favor for perhaps the only 5 megawatt or less CDEV project that's available that has a 20% capacity factor. That is not in our members' best interest. It's not in the customer's best interest. We should have the flexibility to find the best project at the best price with the highest capacity output and the best reliability. We would be forced to forego other projects in other states, and possibly even to forego projects to meet our renewable energy objective. For example, under this bill, the way I interpret it, if we wanted to build a 10-megawatt wind farm in Minnesota, in Luverne, for example, that's not CDEV to meet the South Dakota renewable energy objective, we would not be able to as long as 800 megawatts of CDEV project is not already on the ground. And in our logic, that is not the most cost-effective planning for our members or for their needs. Therefore, on behalf of MRES and our members, I urge you to oppose this bill, and I am open for questions.
Seeing none at this time, Ms. Bergen, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairman Hilty.
Next on the agenda, we have Randy Knott from Northwest Wind Power.
Thank you for the opportunity to let me come and testify. I am the little guy in the room today. I represent a wind farm LLC group that is trying to get started in Northwest Minnesota.
Mr. Knott, we need you to identify yourself for the record also.
I'm sorry, my name
is... Little guy isn't good enough.
To me, that might be a question. My name is Randy Knott from Deep River Falls, Minnesota. And as I was saying, I represent a group of LLC investors that are trying to get a small seabed group going. We brought it through the point of coming up to our power purchase agreement, and I'm new to this. I'm just the average person trying to make an investment and make a go of it. And it was very disheartening the day that we met with our Minn Kota representative, and his opening statement was, "We don't need your power," before any cost, anything else was stated. That was how we started our meeting. So it's a bit daunting. That was in November, and having heard nothing, we started looking at the possibility of a small 5-megawatt project in Red Light County. And one of my partners and I just started looking at it with the thought that it is in an area where we could be possibly hooking into an otter tail line. We have heard that they are much better to deal with, more open and optimistic, and have the thought that we can make this work. My own thoughts, I guess, are as a ratepayer. Right now, my money is essentially leaving the country. And my goal is to literally get a group going and have a community investment where our bank can possibly be our equity investor. The money can stay there. The farmers in my hometown have a stake in it, but also know that the money also stays there. It's going to neighbors, it's going to friends, relatives, people that they know and trust. We take care of gladly the burden of talking to the landowners, getting things set up, the construction, making things work. I know that the previous speaker spoke to the thought of the challenges that it is. It is a challenge. I'm working through it right now, and I'm not getting a wage. It's the hope that we can make this happen. and that's it.
Thank you, Mr. Knott. Are there questions for this witness? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Johnson?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Committee members, my name is Paul Johnson, and I'm an employee of Minnesota Power, an electric utility based in Duluth, Minnesota. And I'm here to testify in opposition to House File 357. As a little background that's relevant to why I'm testifying today is I had the privilege of serving on the Minnesota Legislative Advisory Council for the seabed activity about a year or so ago. And also our company has the privilege of signing the first contract and putting the first seabed project into operation in summer of 2007. With that as a little bit of background, I'd like to get into some specific feedback and input on some components of the bill before you. I'd like to talk about the tariff establishment and a particular phrase in that that refers to, despite their inability to benefit from PTC and other financial incentives. And that, in our interpretation, presents a premise that seabed project pricing is expected to be substantially higher due to the lack of these benefits. And this will make it very much more difficult for seabed projects to be selected and being considered competitive and responding to the resource planning guidelines of the state of Minnesota, which encourages least cost supply and also would show that we're having to choose higher cost resources towards meeting the Minnesota REFs. In terms of the tariff rate, which there's been some discussion on today, I'd like to provide some more explanation about that. The use of the Midwest Independent System Operator pricing reference is independent and does not relate to the true cost and associated pricing for a seabed project. Seabed projects differ in size, location, the wind output you can expect from them, the turbines they use, the interconnection configuration and cost, and their pricing needs to reflect these characteristics, as we found out with our first project and we've considered others. To expand on that, the use of the net present value based on the previous year's MISO day-ahead pricing is flawed. The MISO price is determined by a nodal price. Nodes are all over the place. You determine the price that's available to a specific facility by a specific node, and those prices can vary dramatically. If the average that's spoken about is not a system-wide average, it's the price that's available to that facility to the nearest node that you would be interconnecting at in the overall system. And that price may be high or it may be very low, and it varies frequently based on system conditions. The use of the net present value financial framework being based on historic prices goes against the principles and the very definition of net present value. Net present value is defined as the present value of a series of future net cash flows that result from an investment minus the amount of the original investment. The proposed pricing provision relies on historic pricing, not future net cash flows. Assuming the historic locational marginal pricing, which is all those nodes in the MISO system, will represent LMPs for the next 20 years is presumptuous. There are too many unknowns. The carbon tax, tax credit, political environment, and the marketplace to assume that LMTs will stay flat for 20 years, especially if you're basing that on a historic reference that doesn't accommodate that or reflect that. The provision is also silent on which MISO pricing node should be used to base this calculation on. It is non-specific. There's going to be wind projects all over the place, potentially, and those nodes that are closest to that project, that's the basis for the pricing. The mismatch between the LMT, locational marginal price, is based on dispatchable resources, not wind intermittent resources, which is the nature of wind. When using LMTs for wind generation, you are assuming the wind unit can respond to LMTs. It can't. It's not dispatchable. It's as available when available, similar to a coal or gas generation facility. I'd like to move on to the third point that I have. The priority for seabed projects, which in our interpretation amounts to a carve-out for 800 megawatts of seabed projects. If this provision is applied, it likely will delay the pipeline of projects out there currently that are seabed, larger seabed, non-seabed, and other generation resources other than wind that are needed by the electric utility customers to provide safe electric and reasonably priced power. For what? For the objective to put more seabed in. And I can tell you personally that we've worked very hard at that, and there are some people in this room that know that because they were involved in that process. The delay based on 800 megawatts, if you took the very noteworthy accomplishment of last year of 107 megawatts of seabed being installed, and you were to apply that on an annual basis just as a proxy, you could see this delaying other projects for up to 8 years, 7 to 8 years. That would be a very substantial consequence to put off other non-seabed projects. The standardized contract, and some people have mentioned that, and yes, there needs to be hard work done on good contracting and so forth, and we believe we came to good terms on our contract, and people were all happy when we signed it, and it was implemented, and it's been enforced for the last 2 years. But the one-size-fits-all concept, as we talked about during the advisory committee for seabed, doesn't really fit. There are just too many differences in seabed projects. The structure can vary somewhat, the location, the turbine supplier, the timing of when the project meets critical mass and how the document accommodates that, whether you have everything together the first day you talk to the proposer, or if there's a very spread out process where they delay in getting turbines, delay in getting financing, and so forth. So the negotiation process and the contract need to reflect that. And the pricing that really is very site-specific as well, and project-specific. The sizing. The sizing is a big issue as well. Most conventional projects are driven towards two things. One, you want to have them be an economic size, and two, you want to fully utilize the good wind resource once you find it. And especially if you're lucky to find it close to a point of interconnection in the transmission system where you can reliably deliver it, you don't want to limit that to a small development. You want to fully develop it either initially or in phases to provide lots of renewable energy. And so if you're limited to very small amounts that are higher priced, you're putting a lot of money and effort into a lot of small wind projects that keep us from moving as fast as we need to be keeping things moving towards compliance and fulfillment of the Minnesota Renewable Energy Standards. And we're depriving our ratepayers and our shareholders and all other interested parties from the best wind projects that are out there that just happen not to fit the framework that's proposed in this bill.
Mr. Johnson, if you could wrap up.
Okay, one more comment, and that is the 5 megawatt or less requirement of this bill, which makes it very difficult to get financing, to secure turbine suppliers, to get equity investors, tax investors, and to convince off-takers to take those prices that are being offered. And current market conditions being tight as they are, all of this has been influenced by that. And with that, I just conclude my testimony and just would like to say that Minnesota Power is pleased to have an operating seabed project in the state of Minnesota, and we remain open as a utility to continue to consider seabed projects that are show strong development progress and good economics. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Are there questions for Mr. Johnson?
Representative Galen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this might be for Mr. Johnson or for Representative Falk, but Mr. Johnson, you addressed the standard contract provision and expressed concern about it. My understanding was that the Seabed Task Force actually came around to, I don't know if it was an endorsement or a strong preference for standard contracts to make the process easier. Just a quick answer about whether my recollection is correct on that issue.
My involvement, Mr. Chair, committee members, was that there was a flurry of edits that were going on in the last 36 hours to put that report together, and it made it very difficult to follow that finalization process and up until that point there had been consensus on things that had been talked about at various meetings, but the ultimate product that went through various changes in the last 24 hours, it was hard to track that. So to say that is an accurate representation of all parties involved is not the case.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, I've been hard on the author with questions. I'm going to be hard on you. Here's my question for you, which is that if we listen to Mr. Knott and his testimony, it sounds like the deck is stacked against the little guy. What needs to happen in order to short of this bill? Maybe there is no other alternative other than doing this bill to allow folks that have a 5 megawatt or less that they want to propose be able to get a reasonable shot at doing so. Maybe your perspective is they already got that shot and here's why. But what needs to happen?
Chairman, committee members, I don't think it's a big guy, little guy issue. It's just the projects by their very nature are non-economic in a lot of cases because you have so much cost, fixed cost for project development that whether it's a 5 megawatt or a 50 megawatt project, the turbine suppliers like to warrant support for projects when they have to go out and support warranty performance of those turbines. They don't like doing it for 2 or 3 turbines, which would be what you would be talking about for a 5 megawatt project. They like doing that for 20 or 30 turbines. It's very costly to do that. And when you have a financing entity that has a choice about what to finance or not to finance, they're also looking for the best deal and where they can have secure investment with a stable project portfolio and so forth. So those are the kinds of things that make it difficult. And I think a person sharing with you today who is involved in that process can also attest to that. We work very hard, but it's difficult for small projects to gain that. It really is hard. And we've given it a good effort, but by the very design of it, it goes against it in many ways.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, the point then, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Johnson, is that as I would take from that comment then, that if one of our goals were to be to try to keep some of the projects at 5 or less, keep that money local, as Mr. Knott said, then it would be in our best interest to pass this bill, if that were our goal.
Yes.
Mr. Johnson.
Yes. Yes, it would be, but it would restrict other things, as I've already mentioned. It restricts other projects that are more economic, that are already in the pipeline and are in the planning stages, that would provide more renewable energy at a lower cost to Minnesota ratepayers, and they would be more stable projects by their very nature because of the people and the entities involved.
Understood. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Johnson, how long is the federal PTC tax credit available for people who want to build small wind or large wind?
Currently, it expires the end of this year, but there is proposal in the stimulus bill to go out 3 more years.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
The premium paid for these projects benefits only a few to the detriment of the majority of ratepayers. Now, when I first got elected, we were the 12th lowest rate-paying state in the nation. Somebody said we're over 24th now. Is this going to help ratepayers in Minnesota have lower-priced electricity as well as being a catalyst to growth for economic development, knowing that today the biggest problem facing Minnesota is jobs. And if we have more than the average electricity price, is this going to hurt by having this here and pushing back all the other projects? It's going to hurt in the future in, having more and newer jobs, good paying jobs, by having this mandate.
Mr. Johnson.
Yes. Chairman. The short answer to that is yes, and some reasons why is the pricing that was on the seabed handout here, the net present value of 0.0502, that's 5 cents a kilowatt hour. If you look at the guideline and the statute of what the threshold was for seabed, it's 2.7 cents. This is almost twice that. That's a high cost increase. That's not a little bit. That's a lot. Then, to further expand on that, sir, the turbine suppliers that I know of, that I've talked with and negotiated with and so forth, they're looking for critical mass. Their idea is to make turbines and sell turbines. Their preference is larger projects and a stable pipeline, not smaller projects at the exclusion of being able to put in larger projects over a very, what could be, multiple years based on the design of this bill. So they would be incentivized, in my opinion, to look elsewhere for putting in production facilities and so forth if all they saw out there was a lot of 5 megawatt or less, or maybe a little larger projects in the near term.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Johnson, Mr. Jewell said the increase will be somewhere around the 2 cents per kilowatt hour, and he says it's a slight difference. Really, according to this bill, it should be slightly more than that. What percentage of the average person's utility bill would that increase?
How much,
Mr. Johnson?
Are you asking me how much that would increase the Minnesota, the average Minnesota ratepayer's bill?
Please.
I'm sorry, I can't answer that off the top of my head. I can tell you that it's higher priced energy, and that if you add that amount of energy into the sea of energy that we all use every day, it would be generally higher than the average of that energy supply, for sure.
Thank you.
Representative Overmealy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to ask a couple questions about the issue of pushing back these other projects. Can you tell me how long, on the current seabed project you had, how long it was from the time you signed the contract until you broke ground and actually did the project?
Mr. Johnson?
3 months.
Okay. And is it typical when you're, Mr. Chair, is it typical when you're figuring out kind of what the next plant that might be online, the next wind generation facility, whatever that might be online, to do some planning kind of out into the future? In other words, are you coming up with a, like, looks like over the next 3 months we're going to need more power, we better build a new plant, or do you plan longer than that?
I've been in the resource planning area of the company up until recently. I've kind of worked my way out of that, done that for 17 years. We look at a 15-year purview with a 5-year immediate focus, 5 years out, for real detailed planning. And so that's the purview answer to your question for how far out we look. As far as the specific projects that we have, our most recent resource plan filed with the commission lays that out as to specifics of what renewable resources or non-renewable resources we plan to use to meet any growing need for our customers. That can change and does change months after you file it, just based on market conditions and mining demand changes, new expansions. I mean, it's a dynamic environment for markets that we live in. So,
Mr. Chair, just one follow-up question, if I could, please.
Representative Overmealer, we have 3 other testifiers that have traveled to be here today. We have 15 minutes, and I think since Minnesota Power has a pretty regular presence, maybe we could ask Mr. Johnson or someone from Minnesota Power to be here on Monday to answer further questions that we have for them. I think that we really do need to accommodate the other testifiers today.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to testify today, Mr. Chairman, committee members.
Thank you. Members, the next three testifiers on the list are the ones that we really do need to try to accommodate today. That would be Mr. Ely, Mr. Dahlin, and Mr. Manderscheid. Mr. Ely, if you could come forward and give us your testimony in hopefully about 5 minutes.
Hi, my name is John Ely, and I'm a wind developer from western Minnesota, west central Minnesota, in the Barnesville and Pelican Rapids area. And I'd just like to follow up a little bit on what Paul Johnson said earlier. I've dealt with Minnesota Power. They've been pretty good, really excellent, in comparison, I think, to some other utilities, quite frankly, that I've worked with. And I think the legislation that was written by Representative Falk is kind of a reaction to some problems that CDET has had over the last, since the law, the CDET law was enacted in 2005, that there has been relatively few CDET projects that have been done, in spite of several RFPs, requests for proposals that have been out, issued. You know, it takes, in my case, the Glacial Ridge Wind Project, we were shortlisted on one of XL's first RFPs, 20 megawatt project located in Pope County, and it took us 14 months to go through the negotiation period. And by the time we finished that negotiation, the pricing was no longer good because turbine prices had skyrocketed. So I think you know, a standardized contract is, I think it's critical, you know, for CBED to get, if the state, if the legislators are really serious about doing CBED, then a standardized contract would be a very good thing. And another thing I think that I'd like to address what Paul Johnson had said, had indicated, some of the problems with 5 megawatt projects and, excuse me, and under, and perhaps even 20 megawatt projects, is are the issues of security and turbine supply. And I know I along with some other developers of CBED have kind of addressed this issue through aggregation, and we have aggregated over 167.5 megawatts of CBED projects that could be built, could be put in the ground within a relatively short time frame. We've we're working very closely with turbine manufacturers, and they are very interested in what is going on in the state of Minnesota. But it's a problem of there's so many pieces you know, that are part of this, including the MISO, the Midwest Independent System Operator, has jurisdiction over interconnection, and it's a very long process. And I think that now that the MISO system has transitioned into the new system, that there's probably approximately 800 megawatts or more of CBED projects that could probably be done in a relatively short time frame. And there's a real good chance that many of those projects could be aggregated aggregation in terms of finance, turbine supply, security, and different kinds of things like that. If we could move forward through a relatively quick time frame for PPA negotiations, power purchase agreements, and get a price that really makes sense. When I first started with the CBED stuff in 2004, just prior to that, in 2003, 2002 time period, there was a thing that preceded seabed, which was called REPI, the Renewable Energy Payment Incentive, which was a program that was legislated and put into effect in the 90s somewhere, sometime. There was about 200 megawatts of REPI out there. REPI was a 1.5 incentive payment that was given to primarily or maybe even exclusively to Xcel Energy to boost, to make these projects, small wind projects, financeable. And that 1.5 cents was coupled with Xcel Energy's 3 cent contract, which brought the overall price up to about 4.5 cents a kilowatt hour. Well, the problem with the seabed legislation, back during 2002-2003, the cost to construct a wind energy project was about $1,000 a kilowatt installed. And seabed now in 2009 and beyond, who knows, but you know, it's about $2,000 to $2,500 a kilowatt installed. And those payments just simply haven't kept pace with the reality of what our problems are in terms of not just standardized contracts, but some sort of a pricing mechanism in which we can actually attract investors. Because if we as Minnesotans are serious about keeping some of these profits here in the state of Minnesota to seabed through locally owned wind energy projects, we're going to have to do something to facilitate that, because otherwise many of the seabed projects that you get a contract for, they might be in that 7 cent range or something like that, front loaded, but in other parts of the country, these other utilities are paying more, quite frankly, than that. And and I don't know what Florida Power and Light, or you know, maybe Paul Johnson could speak to that, or some of the other utility executives could speak to what the pricing is starting out at these days. But I've heard it's all secret information. You know, once you do a contract, the PUC can't get that information, probably for good reason. But I think a lot of the contracts are starting out in that 7 cent range. I've done some kind of some back of the envelope estimating for the approximately 800 megawatts of seabed that could be built by 2012. That's representative of about $2 billion worth of construction projects that could be built here in the state of Minnesota. Much of that, obviously, are nacelles and machine houses that are not coming from the state of Minnesota, because they, they're not manufactured here. But towers can be manufactured here, and other kinds of things like that. And then it's the construction part of it that Minnesota construction workers could partake in. I think even more importantly, something that's kind of overlooked sometimes is the huge economic impact that seabed has in the years after what they call the flip, after the investors step out and basically flip these projects to the local communities, in that for a capacity factor for a wind turbine, for a 1 megawatt turbine, I think we're looking at something like if I can find it here.
Mr. Ely, while you're looking, I have to apologize, but we are going to have to ask you to wrap up.
Okay, I just want it's approximately about $1.5 to $2 billion worth of local owner payments, or that could be capitalized, that could be captured by these communities in those years after the flip. And that's a huge amount of money that essentially goes to work in these local communities. The Minnesota ratepayers are going to be purchasing that power from somewhere, and I, as a Minnesotan, really don't want to be purchasing that power from the Dakotas, and or If we have the capabilities to build it right here. So I guess with that, I'll conclude my testimony. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Ely. And members, I do want to try to accommodate our last two testifiers, Mr. Dolan from the Minnesota Municipal Power Agency, who I understand cannot be here on Monday.
Thank you, Chairman Hilty and members of the committee. My name is Derek Dolan. I am the Chief Executive Officer of the Minnesota Municipal Power Agency, and we call it MMPA. It is comprised of 11 member communities, including Anoka, Arlington, Brownton, Buffalo, Chaska, East Grand Forks, Le Sueur, North St. Paul, Olivia, Shakopee, and Winthrop. MMPA has an aggressive wind energy program. I've attached to my comments an MMPA newsletter which provides the latest information on our wind projects. We are installing 12 wind turbines, one in each of our member communities and one at our Faribault Energy Park facility. We call this our hometown wind power program. We will receive the turbines this spring and have the project constructed this year. These units are 165 kilowatts each and show our community's commitment to wind. MMPA has received an allocation of clean renewable energy bonds, so-called CREBs, to finance our hometown wind power program. We also have three wind farms of a total of 288 megawatts under development compared to our total capacity obligation of 400 megawatts. MMPA is not the largest utility in the state. This is very large, though, as a percentage. We began these activities in 2005 and 2006. With applications to the Midwest Independent System Operator, MISO, for transmission service. Our Oak Glen project near Blooming Prairie is 44 megawatts with a projected capital cost of approximately $120 million and an earliest in-service date of the third quarter of 2010. And I want to observe that I use earliest in-service date here because of all the uncertainties there are on transmission and availability of capital and availability of turbines. Our Shell Rock project near Albert Lea is also 44 megawatts with a projected capital cost also of approximately $120 million and an earliest in-service date of the third quarter 2011. Our third wind power farm is as yet unnamed. It would be in southern Minnesota in the fourth quarter of 2012 with a projected capital cost of $540 million. This is a total investment of $780 million if all projects are built. They may not all get built because we may encounter barriers yet. The proposed legislation causes two problems for us that I would like to describe to you. First, we've made a financial commitment to our hometown wind power project for $4 million. It's not particularly a large amount of money, but we've made the commitment for this year. On our other three projects, we have expended $1.7 million in development costs, mostly to obtain transmission from MISO. So this is like the big gamble. You get to put your money out there and find out whether you get it or not. These expenditures would be at risk if the bill is passed because we would have an obligation to purchase seabed projects before constructing our own projects, even though we are 4 years into development on these projects. The second problem is related. If we delay our projects and are unsuccessful in obtaining seabed resources, we would likely fail to meet the renewable energy standards. We would have lost our flexibility. So we have a simple request. We would ask that you modify the bill to allow us to complete the development of the wind projects that I have described to you. No agency or utility in Minnesota is more committed to wind than MMPA. You can see this on our website, mmpa.org. And as an agency owned by its member communities, we provide the benefits of community ownership of all of our resources, including wind, to everyone in our community, not just to investors. Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk with you today. I think I am the most succinct speaker here.
I think that's correct, Mr. Dolan, and we're very appreciative of that. Thank you. Great. Representative Paul.
I have just one question. I know that some previous testifiers, speaking as proponents of the bill, had offered comments that it was ranging on close to $2.5 million per megawatt installed. Just doing some quick math here, with the $120 million for 44 megawatts, you're pretty much the
2.7.
Yeah, your costs are above what these community guys are proposing as average costs.
As an enterprise, we have a lot of experience in constructing power facilities. We built the Faribault Energy Park, which is a $180 million project, and so I would trust my cost estimates more than the other guys, and I'm going to have to live with them.
Thank you, Mr. Stone. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Falk, just out of curiosity, I noticed your bill it goes in effect upon enactment, or as soon as it passes and the governor signs it. What would happen to his project if this bill passes?
Representative Falk.
Representative Gunther, the intent is to facilitate as much community-owned development and reinvesting in Minnesota as possible. And instead of shifting this resource to Wall Street or other foreign multinational companies, we are going to go and say that Minnesota has the ability to have the right to invest in these projects first. We are ensuring that, I wish General Clark was still here, he had some wonderful testimony or comments to me earlier about the level in which the industries surrounding fossil fuels were developed in the Middle East because they retained the dollars. They made sure that they had ownership and they retained the dollars. They built those economies. Now, if we want to be successful and build these new renewable energy economies, we are going to have to invest in them, and that means keeping the dollars local. And so the intent here is to make sure that we focus on a Minnesota-first approach, and there is the possibility that other projects might have to be looked at in how they're structured to maybe make them more community-friendly or to get them to qualify as community-based projects, to open up the ownership to ensure that Minnesotans can invest in them. That's one way we could, I think, partner with some of our utilities to ensure that there is a significant amount of community ownership or that they are community-based projects.
Representative Gunther, we're over time already. Presumably both you and Representative Falk will be here on Monday, and since it's a question for him, maybe you could take that up later. I would still like, if possible, to give Mr. Manderscheid an opportunity to at least give us a few brief remarks in the little time that remains before we get kicked out of here. Mr. Dolan, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, House Committee. I'm Mike Manderscheid, Mayor of the City of Woodstock. We're located in southwest Minnesota along the Buffalo Ridge. Our town population is about 125 people. We have a small rural city, are limited to our revenue possibilities. We have three businesses in our town right now, a grain elevator, a bar and grill, and a treatment center. As you're aware, southwest Minnesota is prime wind and home to many wind turbines. We at the city council wondered why couldn't we as a small community surrounded by turbines and transmission lines have our own turbines. With the help of local wind pioneer Dan Jewell, we got the ball rolling. In 2004, we applied for PPA to our utility in hopes of getting something signed and back so we can get a project started. Excitingly, we kept in touch with Dan, and days became months and months became years. Every time we talked to somebody, we just kept getting the runaround. Dan had ran some numbers for us on a 1 megawatt project, and it would net the community of Woodstock 15% of our budget a year. After 10 years, after the Minnesota flip, it would net us 85% of our budget a year. It comes to my attention that we are going to get our PPA signed, but if we would have had that 4 years ago, that would have helped us out along the way. What a great thing that would be, renewable energy produced in our backyard, revenue generated put back into our city, in turn the city hiring local contractors, purchasing supplies to fix streets and curbs and water repairs. I hope with your help in the future, it will become easier for communities, wind farmers, and small businesses to harness our wind and keep it in the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Members, we are way over time. We will devote the meeting on Monday to a continuation of this. The bill is laid over until
Monday, and this meeting is adjourned.